Hi everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Our third interview of the UK Congress is with Mr. Duncan Spencer. Duncan has been a content partner with the network for a number of years, and we are always privileged to have him come and share his thoughts with us.
Right, our next feature for HSC Online is an interview with Mr. Duncan Spencer, Head of Advice and Practice Systems at IOSH. IOSH, the Institution of Occupational Safety and Health, are the world's biggest professional health and safety membership. The voice of the profession, campaigning on issues that affect millions of working people by setting standards, supporting and developing to connect their members with resources, guidance, events and training. We speak to Duncan today about the impact of mental health first aiders, the challenges of recruiting quality HS professionals, how do we get equality in the boardroom and ISO 45001 controller contractors and continuous improvement. Here we go. To get us started, I guess one of the biggest areas that we've seen an increase in incidents is mental health. You know, we've seen a worrying increase in mental health challenges in the workplace. Corps are looking at ways to reduce the incidents and I guess produce and provide support to their employees when incidents occur. One idea is providing mental health first aiders. I guess what I wanted to ask yourself, Duncan, is what are your thoughts? Is this the magic bullet? Is it a sustainable, reliable solution to help support and reduce mental health issues?
No, I don't think it's a magic bullet, is my first reaction to that. We had some research recently published at IOSH called the Mentor Study. And part of that study was to look at what mental health first aiders were being used for in the workplace and to some degree how effective they were when they were there. And the principal findings of that study and the extrapolation that comes from that indicates very clearly that while mental health first aiders have an important role to play, in their own right, they will not solve your problems. That actually they need to be a part of a whole. So what you need is a full system that primarily, which goes back to the tenets of the health and safety profession, that primarily works to prevent the causes of mental ill health in the workplace, caused by the workplace. And therefore you don't need mental health first aiders because you're not getting people into that situation, you see what I mean? So they become part of the belt and braces process, as does an employee assistance program and so on and so forth. So they in terms of dealing with mental health difficulties, I think that they have a place, but they should be part of that full process. Now that brings in other concerns and other issues that you have to think through, because of course mental health isn't something which is created or within the workplace or you know, elsewhere. It's also created by domestic situations.
Sure.
As well.
It's a much wider issue.
Absolutely, and I know that there's been a long debate over the past decade or two about how far should a business go in terms of reacting to somebody who's bringing difficulties from home into the workplace. But I think where we're getting to now, particularly because of the productivity agenda that we've had in recent years within retail, engineering and so on and so forth, how do you get more for less, so on and so forth, that we've come to realise that that was the wrong way of thinking it through. Because if you do the maths in terms of somebody being ill and off work as a result of mental challenges that they might have, that actually there is a loss there. And so you end up losing money, you lose productivity, you might even lose the person, which then introduces recruitment costs and so on and so forth. So it doesn't really matter now whether somebody is bringing a domestic situation that's affecting the way that they work, whether it's, you know, something that's happening at work that's affecting the way they work, or a combination of both. The fact is that person is suffering, and therefore we ought to do something about it, and we ought to do something about preventing that or building their resilience to be able to deal with those kinds of situations when it flags up for themselves.
Where's the line drawn from a domestic issue to a work issue? Do you feel it's sometimes difficult for a corporation to overstep the mark into more domestic-based issues and challenges? Or would it be the responsibility of the corporation to interfere and try and support?
I don't think you have a right to pry into people's private lives.
Sure.
But what you do have a right to do is to challenge an employee when they are not working at full capacity. So if you, this is what I mean about having a full program that looks at all of the facets of this. So if you are a line manager and you've been appropriately schooled in what to look for around changes of behaviour, for example, in an individual and drop of productivity and so on and so forth, you ought to be in a position where you sensitively approach that with the employee and say, so what's going on?
Sure.
You know, and how can we help? And, you know, and so on and so forth. Because you don't know at that stage whether it's work created or whether it's domestic created or some combination of both or whatever.
Of course.
So it's having that open dialogue. And that's where you know, this IOS study comes in again. It's also having an organisation that has worked upon destigmatising mental health issues in the workplace, because that's really important. And that is one of the things that a mental health first aider can help you to do, because they can help to raise the profile around this and so on and so forth. If you've got a proper system which is transparent to everybody and they appreciate that it's there to help them, they're not going to be penalised by the fact that they come forward saying, boss, I've got an issue here.
I think it's fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but HSE professionals, I feel like they've struggled to perhaps find their way and place in the boardroom. Do you feel now that landscape is changing, or why is it so difficult to perhaps recruit the right HSE professionals?
Crikey, it is a big question there. I think principally, if we change that question slightly and you talk about how many people in CEO positions, managing director positions, chair positions in large national and international corporations have, at least in part, had a health and safety career as part of their portfolio.
Yeah, yeah.
And the answer to that is very, very few.
Of course.
Unless, of course, you're running your own company that is designated as being safety in some way, you know, whether it's a consultancy or it has safety products or whatever it might be, then you might get that. But then when you start to look deeper and you say, okay, well, whereabouts is the safety professional that knocks on the door of that? And you do find nowadays that you get people who are termed as directors of health and safety. But unless they're in construction, very rarely do they actually sit in the board.
Right.
They're usually a director in terms of directing things, but not an executive director. They sit outside of the board. So the fundamental question here is, when you look at a chief executive officer and you say, what is your background? And say, oh, well, I came from personnel, and I came from procurement, I came from finance, I came from whatever. And you say, well, why haven't we got people who said, well, I come from health and safety?
Sure.
And I think the essence to that, when you start to think about it, starts to challenge how do we prepare and how do we develop the career paths of health and safety professionals.
Mm.
And if you look at organisations, membership organisations, WRSM or IOSH or whoever, and what you actually find is that up until relatively recently, all the focus was on how we develop your technical competency,
right?
Not how do we develop your ability to be able to affect change and influence in the workplace.
Absolutely.
So when you look at that more dispassionately, we've had IOSH just run focus groups on this recently, and you hear stories from people who are in leadership positions within the profession who say, you know, I've been trying to recruit somebody to my team, and I got inundated with CVs. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were very poorly written, so I selected, you know, a couple of dozen.
Sure.
And I interviewed those couple of dozen, and actually when you look at them on paper, you can hardly tell the difference between them, because they've all got the same qualification.
Right.
They walk through the door, and I still end up not appointing anybody. Why? Because they can't influence, they can't negotiate, they don't understand how business works, and so on and so forth. So actually, one of the things that is a challenge now within the profession is how do you develop people's career opportunities by giving them the skills to be able to utilise their technical ability more effectively. Because
right.
If you look in you know, many small and medium enterprises, and I accept this as a generalism, but you often find that person is held as solely responsible for health and safety, and you know, they have a very defined remit and so on and so forth. But if you are in a position where you want to progress from that and you want to move into large multi-site businesses, national businesses, global businesses and so on and so forth, if you want to go along the career ladder and elevate yourself to directors and maybe even eventually get onto the board, then you have to, something has to change.
Sure.
You have to understand that actually you can't do safety anymore. Mm. You have to get others to do it for you.
Yeah.
So for example, in my own career, I led the team of the John Lewis Partnership. There was only five of us, yet there were 94,000 partners in the John Lewis Partnership and 450 different sites, everything from agriculture through leisure facilities and different styles of retail outlets and warehouses and da-da-da-da. And the reason why we were able to do it is because we could influence, we could negotiate, we could involve ourselves and get other people to do these kinds of things.
Right.
And that's the kind of skill set that you need if you're going to be seen as a business equal. Because that's the essence, I think, of your question.
Absolutely, yes.
Is how does the profession get business equality?
Business equality, absolutely.
And I think at the moment the key is that we haven't got the right language and we're not acting in the right ways in order to earn that respect.
Yeah.
And if you look at other professions like procurement and like personnel and you track what their membership organisations have been doing over the past 10 years, they've been doing exactly that. They've been changing the way they support their members to enable them to be able to gain these skills and thereby affect their career change. So we have to take a long, hard look at ourselves in terms of how we develop talent within our profession so that we can have that business equality.
That's fantastic. I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. So let's talk about ISO 45001. For the benefit of the viewers who don't know, ISO 45001 is an ISO standard for management systems of occupational health and safety, published in March 2018, and the goal of ISO 45001 is the reduction of occupational injuries and diseases. But my question to yourself, Duncan, is to what are the implications of simplifying OSH controls and management systems?
Okay, so one of the things that is, I have to start by declaring the truth here, which is I've never been a fan of ISO standards and the associated British standards that go with them, because you get ISO standards and international standards, we reinterpret them, we produce British standards accordingly. Never been a great fan of them because for the legislation structure within the UK, it's very clear to me that what the Health and Safety at Work Act says and its daughter regulations, it's elastic law.
Right.
It enables you to be able to look at your own circumstances in your own context and decide what are the safety issues that you have and therefore what are the appropriate ways of controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not been well understood by many people because they've often clamoured for somebody to tell them their answer rather than find it for themselves.
Absolutely.
Hence why you get quite a number of people who are great fans of the approved codes of practice that the HSC produces, so on and so forth. They want somebody to tell them how to do it.
Yeah.
And so traditionally, what you find is that the way that the ISO standards have moved in the past is that it's been another way of telling people how to do safety in the workplace.
Right, okay.
This is what a system looks like.
Right.
The beauty about ISO 45001, and I nearly turned cartwheels when I saw it with glee, is they've actually put a clause within it which makes which challenges many people's idea of what continuous improvement means.
Right.
So all the standards up until now have said you have to continuously improve, and the way traditionally that has been viewed by many people is it's about putting more layers of the onion in place, and you end up getting to a position where inadvertently maybe you've gold-plated safety and you end up with far more controls than is necessary. And actually, long time ago, the effect of you putting more controls in play, it's diminished, the value is very much diminished. So one of the things that I think is really key and really challenging for the profession now is that within the new ISO 45001 standard, it very clearly says in the guidance that goes with that, that continuous improvement includes simplification.
Right.
So that's a challenge to organisations to say, do you know what, you can go too far with safety.
Right.
Which is another way of saying what the HSC says, which is that you should understand your risk, but you should have a proportionate response to it.
Right.
And that's the key thing, is how do you decide when something is proportionate or not? And the idea would be that you understand your context, you understand how your organisation operates, you understand how it's changing, and therefore you need to review your controls and simplify those controls.
Right.
I'll give you another example of how that helps.
Please.
In the 6 months that I worked in the housing sector, I worked for one of the largest housing associations in the country. What I inherited when I started work this project for them was a system where they had 27 different policies in the health and safety area. Mm. And when you went to look at how they did things on the grassroots level, what you found was there were so many policies, all with so many different responsibilities in it, so many different actions that were required of managers, that they completely lost their way. They had no idea what they were supposed to be doing. And as you were trying to amend these things, you know, you'd have to amend 27 different ones every time you made a change and so on and so forth. Right. It became a bureaucratic nightmare.
Wow.
So in order to be able to get over that, what you do is you reduce all of that down to one. Mm. You know, if it's an act, it has a policy. If it doesn't have an act, it has a procedure. and what you suddenly find is suddenly it becomes manageable.
Right.
Not only for you in terms of keeping things up to date,
sure,
but in terms of people understanding what is required of them.
Of course.
So if you give them long, complicated instructions, they'll say, well, this will never work in a month of Sundays, so I'll do the best I can,
right,
and I'll nod in the right direction. But if you can simplify it so that they get to a point where they can have ownership and want to have ownership of it, then you're going to have a much more effective system.
Right.
So that clause within 45001 is really meaningful from the point of view of saying to the profession, stop, you need to think about this.
Sure.
You need to think about how you can do this in a simple way, so it connects with people and you can get buy-in and engagement.
Brilliant. But what about the implication on contractors?
Well, contractors, I have to say from a contractor point of view, in my tenure at John Lewis Partnership, for example, if we had a serious accident, there were one or two, it tended to be with contractors.
Right.
So that would be echoed by, I think, many people in large national and multinational businesses.
Sure.
It tends to be when other people are coming in, because you don't have the same level of control with them. So again, with 45001, what that's done is another significant change within it, is it's asking you to think much more deeply about how you have a working relationship with contractors.
Nice.
That enables you to come to common agreement about what the safety standards are and where you can assign back responsibility for those standards to the contractors, where you don't have a them and us blame kind of culture, but you're very much in partnership in terms of how do you move this forward. In that sense, trying to break down the company barriers so that you're working much more closely together.
Right.
The whole intention of how far you go in your relationship with your contractors and how far you go in dictating to them the standards that you want, or whether you go much further and much more ably by agreeing in partnership what those standards should be.
I see.
And what would be more appropriate.
Okay.
It's a similar kind of idea, if you like, of one of the problems you have with dictating a procedure to somebody working on the shop floor is that they know things for real and how they operate and whether it's possible.
Sure.
And so they were quick to say, actually, that won't happen, boss, because of X, Y, and Z.
Right.
You should have come and talked to me first. Well, in a similar way, if you think about it, if you're asking a contractor to come in and do a piece of work for you, it's because you generally don't have that specialism within your business. And therefore, the same kind of idea applies. So if they're the experts, bring them in. Get them to talk to you about what the standard should be. Get them to have the ownership of it. And that's what 45001 is starting to do. That's the kind of ideas now you hear about from the HS2 business, you know, how they're trying to approach their contractors. Mm. And it seems to be the way forward. So gone in the past, I think we'll be, if we have this conversation again in maybe 5 years' time, I think we'll look back and go, yeah, in the old days, we used to have a score system, and we used to check off whether they got this document, that document, and so on and so forth, and thought we were controlling contractors, but in actual fact, we weren't.
Yeah.
But now we have partnerships, we have dialogue, we have mutual respect, we have a mutual agreement on what the goals are, and we have an open dialogue about how well we're doing to be able to approach that. That we recognise that the contractor has responsibilities, but you also have responsibilities as the client. So I think we will see a much more productive relationship, I hope so, coming out of that.
Fantastic. Well, Duncan, I thank you ever so much for coming. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
And looking forward to working with you again in the future. Best of luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Some very interesting ideas and thoughts shared there. If you want access to more content like this, make sure you subscribe to the HC Network and follow us on LinkedIn. See you in the next interview, where we'll be heading over to Portugal to talk to Ruth Denyer.